It's just a matter of understanding them. His bafflement was intent, but resigned. I've tried all my life to piece them together. I keep thinking, if only I could find the thread, it would all fall into place. Take that, for instance. It was a piece of cloth, linen, once white, now yellow. I disentangled it from the other objects and smoothed it out. It was embroidered with a pattern of stars and flowers, also in white. There were four dainty mother-of-pearl buttons. It was an infant's dress, or nightgown. Aurelius's broad fingers hovered over the tiny garment, wanting to touch, not wanting to mark it with flour. The narrow sleeves would just fit over a finger now. "It's what I was wearing," Aurelius explained. "It's very old.
As old as me, I suppose.
Older than that, even.
Do you think so?
Look at the stitching here, and here. It's been mended more than once. And this button doesn't match. Other babies wore this before you." His eyes flitted from the scrap of linen to me and back to the cloth, hungry for knowledge.
"And there's this."
He pointed at a page of print. It was torn from a book and riddled with creases. Taking it in my hands, I started to read. Not at first aware what was his intention, but when I saw him lift and poise the book and stand in act to hurl it, I instinctively started aside with a cry of alarm. Aurelius took up the phrase and continued, reading not from the page but from memory.
"Not soon enough, however. The volume was flung, it hit me, and I fell, striking my head against the door, and cutting it."
Of course I recognized it. How could I not? For I had read it goodness knows how many times. "Jane Eyre," I said wonderingly.
"You recognized it?" "Yes, it is. I asked a man in the library. It's by Charlotte someone. She had a lot of sisters, apparently."
"Have you read it?"
"Started to. It was about a little girl. She's lost her family, and so her aunt takes her in. I thought I was on to something with that. Nasty woman, the aunt. Not like Mrs. Love at all. This is one of her cousins throwing the book at her, on this page. But later she goes to school, a terrible school, terrible food. But she does make a friend."
He smiled, remembering his reading.
"Only then the friend died."
His face fell.
"And after that, I seemed to lose interest. Didn't read the end. I couldn't see how it fitted after that."
He shrugged off his puzzlement.
"Have you read it? What happened to her in the end? Is it relevant?"
"She falls in love with her employer. His wife, she's mad, lives in the house, but secretly, tries to burn the house down, and Jane goes away. When she comes back, the wife has died, and Mr. Rochester is blind, and Jane marries him."
"Ah."
His forehead wrinkled as he tried to puzzle it all out, but he gave up.
"No, it doesn't make sense, does it? The beginning, perhaps. The girl without the mother. But after that, I wish someone could tell me what it means. I wish there was someone who could just tell me the truth."
He turned back to the torn-out page.
"Probably it's not the book that's important at all. Perhaps it's just this page. Perhaps it has some secret meaning. Look here."
Inside the back cover of his childhood recipe book were tightly packed columns and rows of numbers and letters written in a large, boyish hand.
"I used to think it was a code," he explained. "I tried to decipher it. I tried the first letter of every word, the first of every line, or the second. Then I tried replacing one letter for another."
He pointed to his various trials, eyes feverish, as though there were still a chance he might see something that had escaped him before. I knew it was hopeless. What about this? I picked up the next object and couldn't help giving a shudder. Clearly it had been a feather once, but now it was a nasty, dirty-looking thing. Its oils dried up. The barbs had separated into stiff brown spikes along the cracked spine. Aurelius shrugged his shoulders and shook his head in helpless ignorance, and I dropped the feather with relief. And then there was just one more thing. "Now this," Aurelius began, but he didn't finish. It was a scrap of paper, roughly torn, with a faded ink stain that might once have been a word. I peered at it closely. "I think," Aurelius stuttered.
"Well, Mrs. Love thought. We both agreed, in fact,"
he looked at me in hope,
"that it must be my name."
He pointed.
"It got wet in the rain, but here, just here,"
he led me to the window, gestured at me to hold the paper scrap up to the light,
"something like an A at the beginning, and then an S. Just here, toward the end. Of course, it's faded a bit over the years. You have to look hard. But you can see it, can't you?"
I stared at the stain.
"Can't you?"
I made a vague motion with my head, neither nod nor shake.
"You see, it's obvious when you know what you're looking for, isn't it?"
I continued to look. But the phantom letters that he could see were invisible to my eye.
"And that," he was saying, "is how Mrs. Love settled on Aurelius. Though I might just as easily be Alphonse, I suppose."
He laughed at himself, sadly, uneasily, and turned away.
"The only other thing was the spoon. But you've seen that."
He reached into his top pocket and took out the silver spoon I had seen at our first meeting, when we ate ginger cake while sitting on the giant cats flanking the steps of Angelfield House. "And the bag itself," I wondered. "What kind of a bag is it?"
"Just a bag," he said vaguely.
He lifted it to his face and sniffed it delicately.
"It used to smell of smoke, but not any more."
He passed it to me and I bent my nose to it.
"You see, it's faded now."
Aurelius opened the oven door and took out a tray of pale gold biscuits that he set to cool. Then he filled the kettle and prepared a tray. Cups and saucers, a sugar bowl, a milk jug, and little plates.
"You take this," he said, passing the tray to me.
He opened a door that showed a glimpse of a sitting room, old comfy chairs and floral cushions.
"Make yourself at home. I'll bring the rest in a minute."
He kept his back to me, head bowed as he washed his hands.
"I'll be with you when I've put these things away."
I went into Mrs. Love's front room and sat in a chair by the fireplace, leaving him to stow his inheritance, his invaluable, indecipherable inheritance, safely away. I left the house with something scratching at my mind. Was it something Aurelius had said? Yes, some echo or connection had vaguely appealed for my attention, but had been swept away by the rest of his story. It didn't matter. It would come back to me. In the woods, there is a clearing. Beneath it, the ground falls away steeply and is covered in patchy scrub before it levels out and there are trees again. Because of this, it provides an unexpected vantage point from which to view the house. It was in this clearing that I stopped on my way back from Aurelius's cottage. The scene was bleak. The house, or what remained of it, was ghostly. A smudge of grey against a grey sky. The upper stories on the left-hand side were all gone. The ground floor remained, the doorframe demarcated by its dark stone lintel and the steps that led up to it, but the door itself was gone. It was not a day to be open to the elements, and I shivered for the half-dismantled house. Even the stone cats had abandoned it. Like the deer, they had taken themselves off out of the wet. The right-hand side of the building was still largely intact. though to judge by the position of the crane, it would be next to go. Was all that machinery really necessary, I caught myself thinking. For it looked as if the walls were simply dissolving in the rain. Those stones, still standing, pale and insubstantial as rice paper, seemed ready to melt away under my very eyes if I just stood there long enough. My camera was slung round my neck. I disentangled it from under my coat and raised it to my eyes. Was it possible to capture the evanescent appearance of the house through all this wetness? I doubted it, but was willing to try. I was adjusting the long-distance lens when I caught a slight movement at the edge of the frame. Not my ghost. The children were back. They had seen something in the grass, were bending over it excitedly. What was it? A hedgehog? A snake? Curious, I fine-tuned the focus to see more clearly. One of the children reached into the long grass and lifted the discovery out of it. It was a yellow builder's hat. With a delighted smile, he pushed back his sou'wester, I could see it was the boy now, and placed the hat on his head. Stiff as a soldier he stood, chest out, head up, arms by his side, face intent with concentration to keep the too large hat from slipping. Just as he struck his pose, there came a small miracle. A shaft of sunlight found its way through a gap in the cloud and fell upon the boy, illuminating him in his moment of glory. I clicked the shutter, and my photo was taken. The boy in the hat, over his left shoulder a yellow keep-out sign, and to his right, in the background, the house, a dismal smudge of grey. The sun disappeared, and I took my eye off the children to wind the film and tuck my camera away in the dry. When I looked back, the children were halfway down the drive. His left hand in her right, they were whirling around and around as they approached the lodge gates, equal stride, equal weight, each one a perfect counterbalance to the other. With the tails of their Macintoshes flaring behind them, feet barely skimming the ground, they looked as if they were about to lift into the air and fly. Jane Eyre and the Furnace. When I went back to Yorkshire, I received no explanation for my banishment. Judith greeted me with a constrained smile. The greyness of the daylight had crept under her skin, collected in shadows under her eyes. She pulled the curtains back a few more inches in my sitting room, exposing a bit more window, but it made no difference to the gloom. "Blasted weather!" she exclaimed, and I thought she seemed to be at the end of her tether. Though it was only days, it felt like an eternity. Often night, but never quite day, the darkening effect of the heavy sky threw us all out of time. Miss Winter arrived late to one of our morning meetings. She, too, was pale-faced. I didn't know whether it was the memory of recent pain that put the darkness in her eyes, or something else. "I propose a more flexible timetable for our meetings," she said when she was settled in her circle of light. "Of course. I knew of her bad nights from my interview with the doctor, could see when the medication she took to control her pain was wearing off or had not yet taken full effect. And so we agreed that instead of presenting myself at 9 every morning, I would wait instead for a tap at my door. At first the tap came always between 9 and 10. Then it drifted to later. After the doctor altered her dosage, she took to asking for me early in the mornings, but our meetings were shorter. Then we fell into a habit of meeting twice or three times a day, at random times. Sometimes she called me when she felt well and spoke at length and in detail. At other times she called me when she was in pain. Then it was not so much the company she wanted as the anesthetic qualities of the storytelling itself. The end of my 9 o'clocks was another anchor in time gone. I listened to her story, I wrote the story. When I slept, I dreamed the story, and when I was awake, it was the story that formed the constant backdrop of my thoughts. It was like living entirely inside a book. I didn't even need to emerge to eat, for I could sit at my desk reading my transcript while I ate the meals that Judith brought to my room. Porridge meant it was morning, soup and salad meant lunchtime, steak and kidney pie was evening. I remember pondering for a long time over a dish of scrambled egg. What did it mean? It could mean anything. I ate a few mouthfuls and pushed the plate away. In this long, undifferentiated lapse of time, there were a few incidents that stood out. I noted them at the time, separately from the story, and they are worth recalling here. This is one. I was in the library. I was looking for Jane Eyre and found almost a whole shelf of copies. It was the collection of a fanatic. There were cheap, modern copies with no second-hand value, editions that came up so rarely on the market it would be hard to put a price to them, copies that fell at every point between these two extremes. The one I was looking for was an ordinary, though particular, edition from the turn of the century. While I was browsing, Judith brought Miss Winter in and settled her in the chair by the fire. When Judith had gone, Miss Winter asked, "What are you looking for?" "Jane Eyre." "Do you like Jane Eyre?" she asked. "Very much. Do you?"
"Yes."
She shivered. "Shall I stoke up the fire for you?" She lowered her eyelids as if a wave of pain had come over her.
"I suppose so."
Once the fire was burning strongly again, she said, "Do you have a moment?"
"Sit down, Margaret."
And after a minute of silence, she said this.
"Picture a conveyor belt, a huge conveyor belt, and at the end of it a massive furnace. And on the conveyor belt are books, every copy in the world of every book you've ever loved, all lined up. Jane Eyre, Villette, The Woman in White."
"Middlemarch," I supplied.
"Thank you. Middlemarch. And imagine a lever with two labels, on and off. At the moment, the lever is off. And next to it is a human being with his hand on the lever, about to turn it on. And you can stop it. You have a gun in your hand. All you have to do is pull the trigger. What do you do?"
"No, that's silly."
"He turns the lever to on. The conveyor belt has started."
"But it's too extreme. It's hypothetical."
"First of all, Shirley goes over the edge. I don't like games like this. Now George Sand starts to go up in flames." I sighed and closed my eyes. "Wuthering Heights coming up. Going to let that burn, are you?"
I couldn't help myself. I saw the books, saw their steady process to the mouth of the furnace, and flinched.
"Suit yourself. In it goes. Same for Jane Eyre."
"Jane Eyre." I was suddenly dry-mouthed.
"All you have to do is shoot. I won't tell. No one need ever know."
She waited.
"They've started to fall. Just the first few. But there are a lot of copies. You have a moment to make up your mind."
I rubbed my thumb nervously against a rough edge of nail on my middle finger.
"They're falling faster now."
She didn't remove her gaze from me.
"Half of them gone. Think, Margaret. All of Jane Eyre will soon have disappeared forever. Think."
Miss Winter blinked.
2/3 gone. Just one person, Margaret. Just one tiny, insignificant little person."
I blinked.
"Still time, but only just. Remember, this person burns books. Does he really deserve to live?"
Blink, blink.
"Last chance."
Blink, blink, blink. Jane Eyre was no more.
"Margaret!"
Miss Winter's face twisted in vexation as she spoke. She beat her left hand against the arm of her chair. Even the right hand, injured though it was, twitched in her lap. Later, when I transcribed it, I thought it was the most spontaneous expression of feeling I had ever seen in Miss Winter. It was a surprising amount of feeling to invest in a mere game. And my own feelings? Shame. For I had lied. Of course I loved books more than people. Of course I valued Jane Eyre over the anonymous stranger with his hand on the lever. Of course all of Shakespeare was worth more than a human life. Of course. Unlike Miss Winter, I had been ashamed to say so. On my way out, I returned to the shelf of Jane Eyre's and took the one volume that met my criteria. Right age, right kind of paper, right typeface. In my room I turned the pages till I found the place. Not at first aware what was his intention, but when I saw him lift and poise the book and stand in act to hurl it, I instinctively started aside with a cry of alarm. Not soon enough, however. The volume was flung, it hit me, and I fell, striking my head against the door and cutting it. The book was intact. Not a single page was missing. This was not the volume Aurelius's page had been torn from. But in any case, why should it be? If his page had come from Angelfield, if it had, then it would have burned with the rest of the house. For a time I sat doing nothing, only thinking of Jane Eyre and a library and a furnace and a house fire. But no matter how I combined and recombined them, I couldn't make sense of it. The other thing I remember from this time was the incident of the photograph. A small parcel appeared with my breakfast tray one morning, addressed to me in my father's narrow handwriting. It was my photographs of Angelfield. I'd sent him the canister of film, and he had had it developed for me. There were a few clear pictures from my first day. Brambles growing through the wreckage of the library, ivy snaking its way up the stone staircase. I halted at the picture of the bedroom, where I'd come face to face with my ghost. Over the old fireplace, there was only the glare of a flashbulb reflected. Still, I took it out of the bundle and tucked it inside the cover of my book, to keep. The rest of the photographs were from my second visit, when the weather had been against me. Most of them were nothing but puzzling compositions of murkiness. What I remembered was shades of grey overlaid with silver, the mist moving like a veil of gauze, my own breath a tipping point between air and water. But my camera had captured none of that, nor was it possible in the dark smudges that interrupted the grey to make out a stone, a wall, a tree, or a forest. After half a dozen such pictures, I gave up looking. Stuffing the wad of photos in my cardigan pocket, I went downstairs to the library. We were about halfway through the interview when I became aware of a silence. I was dreaming, lost, as usual, in her world of childhood twinship. I replayed the soundtrack of her voice, recalled a changed tone, the fact that she had addressed me, but couldn't recall the words. "What?" I said.
"Your pocket," she repeated. "You have something in your pocket."
"Oh, it's some photographs." In that limbo state halfway between a story and your life, when you haven't caught up with your wits yet, I mumbled on. "Angelfield," I said. By the time I returned to myself, the pictures were in her hands. At first she looked closely at each one, straining through her glasses to make sense of the blurred shapes. As one indecipherable image followed another, she let out a small Vida Winter sigh, one that implied her low expectations had been amply fulfilled, and her mouth tightened into a critical line. With her good hand, she began to flick through the pile of pictures more cursorily. To show that she no longer expected to find anything of interest, she tossed each one after the briefest glance onto the table at her side. I was mesmerized by the discarded photos landing at a regular rhythm on the table. They formed a messy sprawl on the surface, flopping on top of each other and gliding over each other's slippery surfaces, with a sound like useless, useless, useless. Then the rhythm came to a halt. Miss Winter was sitting with intent rigidity, holding up a single picture and studying it with a frown. She's seen a ghost, I thought. Then after a long moment, pretending not to feel my gaze upon her, she tucked the photo behind the remaining dozen and looked at the rest, tossing them down just as before. When the one that had arrested her attention resurfaced, she barely glanced at it, but added it to the others.
"I wouldn't have been able to tell it was Angelfield, but if you say so," she said icily.
And then, in an apparently artless movement, she picked up the whole pile, and holding them toward me, dropped them.
"My hand. Do excuse me," she murmured, as I bent down to retrieve the pictures. But I wasn't deceived. And she picked up her story where she had left it.
Later, I looked through the pictures again. For all that the dropping of the photos had muddled the order, it wasn't difficult to tell which one had struck her so forcefully. In the bundle of blurred, greyed images, there was really only one that stood out from the rest. I sat on the edge of my bed, looking at the image, remembering the moment well. The thinning of the mist and the warming of the sun had combined just at the right time to allow a ray of light to fall onto a boy who posed stiffly for the camera, chin up, back straight, eyes betraying the anxious knowledge that at any minute his hard yellow hat was going to slip sideways on his head. Why had she been so taken by that photograph? I scanned the background, but the house, half demolished already, was only a dismal smear of grey over the child's right shoulder. Closer to him, all that was visible was the grill of the safety barrier and the corner of the keep-out sign. Was it the boy himself who interested her? I puzzled over the picture for half an hour, but by the time I came to put it away, I was no nearer an explanation. Because it perplexed me, I slipped it inside the cover of my book, along with the picture of an absence in a mirror frame. Apart from the photograph of the boy and the game of Jane Eyre and the furnace, not much else pierced the cloak the story had cast over me. The cat, I remember. He took note of my unusual hours, came scratching at my door for a bit of fuss at random hours of the day and night, finished up bits of egg or fish from my plate. He liked to sit on my piles of paper, watching me write. For hours I could sit scratching at my pages, wandering in the dark labyrinth of Miss Winter's story. But no matter how far I forgot myself, I never quite lost my sense of being watched over. And when I got particularly lost, it was the gaze of the cat that seemed to reach into my muddle and light my way back to my room, my notes, my pencils, and my pencil sharpener. He even slept with me on my bed some nights. And I took to leaving my curtains open so that if he woke, he could sit on my windowsill seeing things move in the dark that were invisible to the human eye. And that is all. Apart from these things, there was nothing else. Only the eternal twilight and the story. Collapse. Isabel had gone. Hester had gone. Charlie had gone. Now Miss Winter told me of further losses.
Up in the attic, I leaned with my back against the creaking wall. I pressed back to make it give, then released it. Over and over. I was tempting fate. What would happen, I wondered, if the wall came down? Would the roof cave in? Would the weight of it falling cause the floorboards to collapse? Would roof tiles and beams and stone come crashing through ceilings onto the beds and boxes as if there were an earthquake? And then what? Would it stop there? How far would it go? I rocked and rocked, taunting the wall, daring it to fall, but it didn't. Even under duress, it is astonishing just how long a dead wall will stay standing. Then, in the middle of the night, I woke up, ears a jangle. The noise of it was finished already, but I could still feel it resounding in my eardrums and in my chest. I leaped out of bed and ran to the stairs, Emmeline at my heels. We arrived on the galleried landing at the same time that John, who slept in the kitchen, arrived at the foot of the stairs, and we all stared. In the middle of the hallway, the missus was standing in her nightdress, staring upward. At her feet was a huge block of stone, and above her head, a jagged hole in the ceiling. The air was thick with grey dust. It rose and fell in the air, undecided where to settle. Fragments of plaster, mortar, wood were still falling from the floor above, with a sound like mice scattering. And from time to time I felt Emmeline jump as planks and bricks fell in the floors above. The stone steps were cold. Then splinters of wood and shards of plaster and mortar dug into my feet. In the centre of all the detritus of our broken house, with the swirls of dust slowly settling around her, the missus stood like a ghost. Dust-grey hair, dust-grey face and hands, dust-grey the folds of her long nightdress. She stood perfectly still and looked up. I came close to her and joined my stare to hers. We gazed through the hole in the ceiling, and beyond that another hole in another ceiling, and then yet another hole in another ceiling. We saw the peony wallpaper in the bedroom above, the ivy trellis pattern in the room above that, and the pale grey walls of the little attic room. Above all of that, high above our heads, we saw the hole in the roof itself and the sky. There were no stars. I took her hand. "Come on," I said. "It's no use looking up there." I led her away, and she followed me like a little child. "I'll put her to bed," I told John. Ghost white, he nodded. "Yes," he said, in a voice thick with dust. He could hardly bear to look at her. He made a slow gesture toward the destroyed ceiling. It was the slow motion of a drowning man dragged under by the current. "And I'll sort this out." But an hour later, when the missus was clean and in a fresh nightdress, tucked up in bed and asleep, he was still there, exactly as I had left him, staring at the spot where she had been. The next morning, when the missus did not appear in the kitchen, it was I who went to wake her. She could not be woken. Her soul had departed through the hole in the roof, and she was gone. "We've lost her," I told John in the kitchen. "She's dead." His face didn't change. He continued to stare across the kitchen table as though he hadn't heard me. "Yes," he said eventually, in a voice that did not expect to be heard. "Yes." It felt as if everything had come to an end. I had only one wish. To sit like John, immobile, staring into space and doing nothing. Yet time did not stop. I could still feel my heartbeat measuring out the seconds. I could feel hunger growing in my stomach and thirst in my throat. I was so sad I thought I would die. Yet instead I was scandalously and absurdly alive, so alive I swear I could feel my hair and my fingernails growing. For all the unbearable weight on my heart, I could not, like John, give myself up to the misery. Hester was gone. Charlie was gone. The missus was gone. John, in his own way, was gone, though I hoped he would find his way back. In the meantime, the girl in the mist was going to have to come out of the shadows. It was time to stop playing and grow up. "I'll put the kettle on, then," I said. "Make a cup of tea." My voice was not my own. Some other girl, some sensible, capable, ordinary girl, had found her way into my skin and taken me over. She seemed to know just what to do. I was only partly surprised. Hadn't I spent half my life watching people live their lives? Watching Hester, watching the missus, watching the villagers. I settled quietly inside myself while the capable girl boiled the kettle, measured out the tea leaves, stirred and poured. She put 2 sugars in John's tea, 3 in mine. When it was made, I drank it, and as the hot, sweet tea reached my stomach, at last I stopped trembling.
The Silver Garden. Before I was quite awake, I had the sense that something was different. And a moment later, before I even opened my eyes, I knew what it was. There was light. Gone were the shadows that had lurked in my room since the beginning of the month. Gone, too, the gloomy corners and the air of mournfulness. The window was a pale rectangle, and from it there entered a shimmering paleness that illuminated every aspect of my room. It was so long since I'd seen it that I felt a surge of joy, as though it weren't just a night that had ended, but winter. It was as if spring had come. The cat was on the window ledge, gazing intently into the garden. Hearing me stir, he immediately jumped down and pawed at the door to go out. I pulled my clothes and coat on, and we crept downstairs together, to the kitchen and the garden. I realized my mistake the moment I stepped outdoors. It was not day, it was not the sun, but moonlight that shimmered in the garden, edging the leaves with silver and touching the outlines of the statuary figures. I stopped still and stared at the moon. It was a perfect circle, hanging palely in a clear sky. Mesmerized, I could have stood there till daybreak. But the cat, impatient, pressed my ankles for attention, and I bent to stroke him. No sooner had I touched him than he moved away, only to pause a few yards off and look over his shoulder. I turned up the collar of my coat, shoved my cold hands in my pockets, and followed. He led me first down the grassy path between the long borders. On our left, the yew hedge gleamed brightly. On the right, the hedge was dark in the moon shadow. We turned into the rose garden, where the pruned bushes appeared as piles of dead twigs, but the elaborate borders of box that surrounded them in sinuous Elizabethan patterns twisted in and out of the moonlight, showing here silver, there black. A dozen times I would have lingered, a single ivy leaf turned at an angle to catch the moonlight perfectly, a sudden view of the great oak tree etched with inhuman clarity against the pale sky. But I couldn't stop. All the time, the cat stalked on ahead of me with a purposeful, even step, tail raised like a tour guide's umbrella signaling, "This way, follow me." In the walled garden, he jumped up onto the wall that bordered the fountain pool and padded halfway around its perimeter, ignoring the moon's reflection that shone in the water like a bright coin at the bottom of the pool. And when he came level with the arched entrance to the winter garden, he jumped down and walked toward it. Under the arch, he paused. He looked left and right, intent, saw something, and slunk off out of sight toward it. Curious, I tiptoed forward to stand where he had and look around. A winter garden is colourful when you see it at the right time of day, at the right time of year. Largely it depends on daylight to bring it to life. The midnight visitor has to look harder to see its attractions. It was too dark to see the low, wide spread of hellebore leaves against the dark soil. Too early in the season for the brightness of snowdrops. Too cold for the daphne to release its fragrance. There was witch hazel, though. Soon its branches would be decorated with trembling yellow and orange tassels, but for now it was the branches themselves that were the main attraction. Fine and leafless, they were delicately knotted, twisting randomly and with elegant restraint. At its foot, hunched over the ground, was the rounded silhouette of a human figure. I froze. The figure heaved and shifted laboriously, releasing gasping puffs of breath and effortful grunts. In a long, slow second, my mind raced to explain the presence of another human being in Miss Winter's garden at night. Some things I knew instantly, without needing even to think about them. For a start, it was not Maurice kneeling on the ground there. Though he was the least unlikely person to find in the garden, it never occurred to me to wonder whether it might be him. This was not his wiry frame. These not his measured movements. Equally, it was not Judith. Neat, calm Judith, with her clean nails, perfect hair, and polished shoes, scrabbling about in the garden in the middle of the night, impossible. I didn't need to consider these two. And so I didn't. Instead, in that second, my mind reeled to and fro 100 times between two thoughts. It was Miss Winter. It couldn't be Miss Winter. It was Miss Winter, because it was. I could tell. I could sense it. It was her, and I knew it. It couldn't be her. Miss Winter was frail and ill. Miss Winter was always in her wheelchair. Miss Winter was too unwell to bend to pluck out a weed, let alone crouch on the cold ground, disturbing the soil in this frantic fashion. It wasn't Miss Winter. But somehow, impossibly, despite everything, it was. That first second was long and confusing. The second, when it finally came, was sudden. The figure froze, swiveled, rose, and I knew. Miss Winter's eyes, brilliant, supernatural green. But not Miss Winter's face. A patchwork of scarred and mottled flesh, crisscrossed by crevices deeper than age could make. Two uneven dumplings of cheeks, lopsided lips, one half a perfect bow that told of former beauty, the other a twisted graft of white flesh. Emmeline. Miss Winter's twin. Alive and living in this house. My mind was in turmoil. Blood was pounding in my ears. Shock paralyzed me. She stared at me, unblinking, and I realized she was less startled than I was. But still, she seemed to be under the same spell as me. We were both cast into immobility. She was the first to recover. In an urgent gesture, she raised a dark, soil-covered hand toward me, and in a hoarse voice rasped a string of senseless sounds. Bewilderment slowed my responses. I couldn't even stammer her name before she turned and hurried away, leaning forward, shoulders hunched. From out of the shadows emerged the cat. He stretched calmly, and ignoring me, took himself off after her. They disappeared under the arch, and I was alone. Me and a patch of churned-up soil. Foxes, indeed. Once they were gone, I might have been able to persuade myself that I had imagined it. That I had been sleepwalking, and that in my sleep I had dreamed that Adeline's twin appeared to me and hissed a secret, unintelligible message. But I knew it was real. And though she was no longer visible, I could hear her singing as she departed. That infuriating, tuneless, five-note fragment.
La, 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 la.
I stood, listening, until it faded completely away. Then, realizing that my feet and hands were freezing, I turned back to the house. Phonetic alphabet. A great many years had passed since I learnt the phonetic alphabet. It began with a chart in a linguistics book in Father's shop. There was no reason for my interest at first, other than that I had nothing to do one weekend and was enamoured of the signs and symbols it contained. There were familiar letters and foreign ones. There were capital N's that weren't the same as little N's and capital Y's that weren't the same as little Y's. Other letters, N's and D's and S's and Z's, had funny little tails and loops attached, and you could cross H's and I's and U's as if they were T's. I loved these wild and fanciful hybrids. I filled pages of paper with M's that turned into J's and V's that perched precariously on tiny O's like performing dogs on balls at the circus. My father came across my pages of symbols and taught me the sounds that went with each. In the International Phonetic Alphabet, I discovered, you could write words that looked like math, words that looked like secret code, words that looked like lost languages. I needed a lost language, one in which I could communicate with the lost. I used to write one special word over and over again, my sister's name, a talisman. I folded the word into elaborate miniature origami, kept my pleat of paper always close to me. In winter it lived in my coat pocket. In summer it tickled my ankle inside the fold of my sock. At night I fell asleep clutching it in my hand. For all my care, I didn't always keep track of these bits of paper. I lost them, made new ones, then came across the old ones. When my mother tried to prize one from my fingers, I swallowed it to thwart her, even though she wouldn't have been able to read it. But when I saw my father pick a grayed and fraying fold of paper out of the junk in the bottom of the drawer and unfold it, I did nothing to stop him. When he read the secret name, his face seemed to break, and his eyes, when they rose to me, were full of sorrow. He would have spoken. He opened his mouth to speak, but raising my fingers to my lips, I commanded his silence. I would not have him speak her name. Had he not tried to shut her away in the dark? Had he not wanted to forget her? Had he not tried to keep her from me? He had no right to her now. I prized the paper from his fingers. Without a word, I left the room. On the window seat of the second floor, I put the morsel of paper in my mouth, tasted its dry, woody tang, and swallowed. For 10 years, my parents had buried her name in silence, trying to forget. Now I would protect it in a silence of my own, and remember. Alongside my mispronunciation of hello, goodbye, and sorry in 17 languages, and my ability to recite the Greek alphabet forward and backward, I, who have never learned a word of Greek in my life, the phonetic alphabet was one of those secret random wells of useless knowledge left over from my bookish childhood. I learned it only to amuse myself. Its purpose in those days was merely private, so as the years passed I made no particular effort to practice it. That's why, when I came in from the garden and put pencil to paper to capture the sibilants and fricatives, the plosives and trills of Emmeline's urgent whisper, I had to make several attempts. After 3 or 4 goes, I sat on the bed and looked at my line of squiggles and symbols and signs. Was it accurate? Doubts began to assail me. Had I remembered the sounds accurately after my 5-minute journey back into the house? Was my recollection of the phonetic alphabet itself adequate? What if my first failed attempts had contaminated my memory? I whispered what I had written on the paper. Whispered it again, urgently. Waited for the birth of some answering echo in my memory to tell me I'd got it right. Nothing came. It was the travestied transcription of something misheard and then only half remembered. It was useless. I wrote the secret name instead. The spell. The charm. The talisman. It had never worked. She never came. I was still alone. I screwed the paper into a ball and kicked it into a corner. The ladder. My story isn't boring you, is it, Miss Lee? I endured a number of such comments the following day, as unable to suppress my yawns, I fidgeted and rubbed my eyes while listening to Miss Winter's narration. I'm sorry. I'm just tired.
Tired? She exclaimed. You look like death warmed up. A proper meal should put you right. Whatever's the matter with you?
I shrugged my shoulders. Just tired. That's all. She pursed her lips and regarded me sternly, but I said nothing more, and she took up her story.
For 6 months, things went on. We sequestered ourselves in a handful of rooms, the kitchen, where John still slept at night, the drawing room and the library. We girls used the back stairs to get from the kitchen to the one bedroom that seemed secure. The mattresses we slept on were those we had dragged from the old room, the beds themselves being too heavy to move. The house had felt too big anyway, since the household had been so diminished in number. We survivors felt more at ease in the security, the manageability of our smaller accommodation. All the same, we could never quite forget the rest of the house, slowly festering behind closed doors, like a moribund limb. Emmeline spent much of her time inventing card games. "Play with me." "Oh, go on, do play," she would pester. Eventually I gave in and played. Obscure games, with ever-shifting rules, games only she understood, and which she always won, which gave her constant delight. She took baths. She never lost her love of soap and hot water, spent hours luxuriating in the water I'd heated for the laundry and washing up. I didn't begrudge her. It was better if at least one of us could be happy. Before we closed up the rooms, Emmeline had gone through cupboards belonging to Isabel and taken dresses and scent bottles and shoes, which she hoarded in our campsite of a bedroom. It was like trying to sleep in a dressing-up box. Emmeline wore the dresses. Some were out of date by 10 years. Others, belonging to Isabel's mother, I presume, were 30 and 40 years old. Emmeline entertained us in the evenings by making dramatic entrances into the kitchen in the more extravagant outfits. The dresses made her look older than 15. They made her look womanly. I remembered Hester's conversation with the doctor in the garden. There is no reason why Emmeline should not marry one day. And I remembered what the missus had told me about Isabel and the picnics. She was the kind of girl men can't look at without wanting to touch. And I felt a sudden anxiety. But then she flopped down on a kitchen chair, took a pack of cards from a silk purse and said, all child, "Play cards with me. Go on." I was half reassured, but still, I made sure she did not leave the house in her finery. John was listless. He did rouse himself to do the unthinkable, though. He got a boy to help in the garden. "It'll be all right," he said. "It's only old Proctor's boy, Ambrose. He's a quiet lad. It won't be for long, only till I get the house fixed up. That, I knew, would take forever. The boy came. He was taller than John and broader across the shoulders. They stood hands in pockets, the two of them, and discussed the day's work, and then the boy started. He had a measured, patient way of digging. The smooth, constant chime of spade on soil got on my nerves. "Why do you have to have him?" I wanted to know. "He's an outsider, just like the others." But for some reason the boy wasn't an outsider to John. Perhaps because he came from John's world, the world of men, the world I didn't know. "He's a good lad," John said time and time again in answer to my questions. "He's a hard worker. He doesn't ask too many questions and he doesn't talk too much." "He might not have a tongue, but he's got eyes in his head." John shrugged and looked away, uneasy. "I won't always be here," he said eventually. "Things can't go on forever like this." He sketched a vague gesture that took in the house, its inhabitants, the life we led in it. "One day, things will have to change."
"Change?
You're growing up. It won't be the same, will it? It's one thing being children, but when you're grown up..." But I was already gone. I didn't want to know what it was he had to say. Emmeline was in the bedroom, picking sequins off an evening scarf for her treasure box. I sat down beside her. She was too absorbed in her task to look up when I came in. Her plump, tapered fingers picked relentlessly at a sequin until it came away, then dropped it into the box. It was slow work, but then Emmeline had all the time in the world. Her calm face never changed as she bent over the scarf, lips together, her gaze at once intent and dreamy. Every so often her eyelids descended, closing off the green irises, then, as soon as they had touched the lower lid, rising again to reveal the green unchanged. Did I really look like that? I wondered. Oh, I knew what a good match my eyes were to hers in the mirror. And I knew we had the same sideways kink underneath the weight of red hair at the back of our necks. And I knew the impact we could make on the villagers on those rare occasions when we walked arm in arm, down the street in matching dresses. But still, I didn't look like Emmeline, did I? My face could not do that placid concentration. It would be screwed up in frustration. I would be biting my lip, pushing my hair angrily back over my shoulder and out of the way, huffing with impatience. I would not be tranquil like Emmeline. I would bite the sequins off with my teeth. "You won't leave me, will you?" I wanted to say. "Because I won't leave you, we'll stay here forever, together, whatever John the Dig says." "Why don't we play?" She continued her silent work as though she hadn't heard me. "Let's play getting married. You can be the bride. Go on. You can wear this." I pulled a yellow piece of gauzy stuff from the pile of finery in the corner. "It's like a veil. Look." She didn't look up, not even when I tossed it over her head. She just brushed it out of her eyes and carried on picking at her sequin. And so I turned my attention to her treasure box. Hester's keys were still in there, still shiny, though Emmeline had, so far as one could tell, forgotten their previous keeper. There were bits and pieces of Isabel's jewellery, the coloured wrappers from the sweets Hester had given her one day, an alarming shard of glass from a broken green bottle, a length of ribbon with a gold edge that used to be mine, given to me by the missus more years ago than I could remember. Underneath all the other junk, there would still be the threads of silver she had worked out of the curtains the day Hester arrived. And half hidden beneath the jumble of rubies, glass and junk, there was something that didn't seem to belong. something leather. I put my head on one side to get a better view. Ah, that was why she wanted it. Gold lettering. I-A-R. What was I-A-R? Or who was I-A-R? Tilting my head the other way, I caught sight of something else. A tiny lock. And a tiny key. No wonder it was in Emmeline's treasure box. Gold letters and a key. I should think it was her prized possession. And suddenly it struck me. I-A-R. Diary. I reached out a hand. Quick as a flash, her looks could be deceiving, Emmeline's hand came down like a vise on my wrist and stopped me from touching. Still, she didn't look at me. She moved my hand away with a firm movement and brought the lid down on her box. There were white pressure marks on my wrist where she had held me. I'm going to go away, I said experimentally. My voice didn't sound terribly convincing. I am, and I'm going to leave you here. I'm going to grow up and live on my own. Then, full of dignified self-pity, I stood up and walked out of the room. It wasn't until the end of the afternoon that she came to find me on the window seat in the library. I had drawn the curtain to hide me, but she came straight to the place and peered around. I heard her approaching steps, felt the curtain move when she lifted it. Forehead pressed against the glass, I was watching the drops of rain against the window pane. The wind was making them shiver. They were constantly threatening to set off one of their zigzag courses where they swallow up every droplet in their path and leave a brief silvery trail behind. She came to me and rested her head against my shoulder. I shrugged her off angrily. Would not turn and speak to her. She took my hand and slipped something onto my finger. I waited for her to go before I looked. A ring. She had given me a ring. I twisted the stone inward to the palm side of my finger and brought it close to the window. The light brought the stone to life. Green. Like the colour of my eyes. Green, like the colour of Emmeline's eyes. She had given me a ring. I closed my fingers into my palm and made a tight fist with the stone at its heart. John collected buckets of rainwater and emptied them. He peeled vegetables for the pot. He went to the farm and returned with milk and butter. But after every task, his slowly gathered energy seemed exhausted, and every time I wondered whether he would have the strength to heave his lean frame up from the table to get on with the next thing. "Shall we go to the topiary garden?" I asked him. "You might show me what to do there." He didn't reply. He hardly heard me, I think. For a few days I left it, then I asked again, and again. And again. Eventually he went to the shed, where he sharpened the pruning shears with his old smooth rhythm. Then we lifted down the long ladders and carried them out of doors. "Like this," he said, reaching to show me the safety catch on the ladder. He extended the ladder against the solid garden wall. I practiced the safety catch a few times, then went up a few feet and down again. "It won't feel so secure when it's resting against you," he told me. "It's safe enough if you get it right. You have to get a feel for it." And then we went to the topiary garden. He led me to a medium-sized U-shape that had grown shaggy. I went to rest the ladder against it, but, "No, no," he cried, "too impatient." 3 times he walked slowly around the tree. Then he sat down on the ground and lit a cigarette. I sat down and he lit one for me, too. "Never cut into the sun," he told me. and don't cut into your own shadow. He drew a few times on his cigarette. Be wary of clouds. Don't let them skew your line when they blow about. Find something permanent in your line of vision, a roof or a fence. That's your anchor. And never be in a hurry. 3 times as long in the looking as in the cutting. He never lifted his eye from the tree all the time he spoke, and neither did I. You have to have a feeling for the back of the tree while you're trimming the front, and the other way around, and don't just cut with the shears. Use your whole arm, all the way up to your shoulder. We finished the cigarettes and stubbed out the ends under the toes of our boots. And how you see it now from a distance. Keep that in your head when you're seeing it close up. I was ready. 3 times he let me rest the ladder against the tree before he was satisfied it was safe. And then I took the shears and went up. I worked for 3 hours. At first I was conscious of the height, kept looking down, had to force myself to go 1 more step up the ladder. And each time I moved the ladder, it took me several goes to get it safe. But gradually the task took me over. I hardly knew how high I was, so absorbed was my mind in the shape I was making. John stood by, mostly silent. Once in a while he made a comment. Watch your shadow, or think of the back. But mostly he just watched and smoked. It was only when I came down from the ladder for the last time, slipped the safety catch and telescoped it, that I realized how sore my hands were from the weight of the shears. But I didn't care. I stood well back to study.